This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Jack Ablin's our first guest, Chief Investment Officer and Founding Partner at Crescent Capital. Thanks for joining us today, Jack.
Thanks, John.
I was nodding at your reporting on what the market did yesterday after the Fed announced 75 basis points. It was kind of interesting, wasn't it? Because you wrote, Chairman Powell came out swinging yesterday and sent the market south. But at first, the markets jumped. It was up. The Dow was up 300 and then down 200. We had a 500-point swing yesterday within 20 minutes, right?
Yeah, that's it. I think it was really the difference between the data and the what I call the federal open mouth policy.
Huh.
And that it's been a huge difference. My view is, look, the Fed wants spending curtailed. They're going after the jobs market because, look, 80% of American households rely on their paychecks to fuel spending. And 20% of American households rely on the value of their stock portfolio to kind of gauge spending. So the Fed would like to see wages or at least wage growth drop with higher unemployment. And they would also like to see the stock market drop. Why did the market rally so much last month? Because the Fed was in a quiet period leading up to this yesterday's announcement. And so it was like the teenage house party where the parents were out of town for a while, and of course now the dad came back and laid down the law.
But if they had raised it 75 basis points and then he had been more moderate in his remarks or silent, you think it would not have dropped? It would have not gone the other way?
Yeah, I think that the rationale is that The Fed has ratcheted rates at an unprecedented rate because they got a late start, and I can go into details why, mostly political, but they ratcheted up rates quickly, and we know that it takes a lot of time from when you turn the dial till you feel the effect in the economy.
Yeah.
And so the general thinking was, all right, we've ratcheted up from essentially 0 to 4%, and let's see what let's take a step back and see what happens.
I heard someone say this week that it's not like we haven't had, say, 7% on a 30-year fixed mortgage before, but we've never had it 5 months from 2.5%. 7% isn't crazy. It's a 4.5-point swing in less than half a year. That's what's been crazy.
You're right, John. It's the direction. I mean, the fact is, if rates were 9% 6 months ago and they're 7% now, that's very different than when they were 2.5% and they're 7% now. So anyone inclined to refinance will likely not refinance their 2.5% mortgage into a 7% mortgage.
So what else do you think is lagging? What other monsters are going to come out of the closet here?
Yeah, it's hard to really tell, but certainly policy is, and we're seeing the effects already on interest rate sensitive, right? You mentioned housing, sure. New car prices are also falling. I will say just as an aside, I think we're in, the housing market in American households are in much better position this time around than we were, 14 years ago or so. Because most of the mortgages in place these days are fixed. So if somebody's sitting in their home at a 3.5% mortgage, as long as they don't have to move, they can pretty much sit there and make their payments and nothing's going up. Last time around, everything was adjustable and it was, all hell broke loose. But, I think we're going to start to see layoffs. Amazon, other big tech companies are, imposing hiring freezes. The Fed believes that the unemployment rate needs to get certainly above 4.5%, and still a pretty far cry from where we are right now.
We'll pick it up here in a minute. We're visiting with Jack Ablin, Chief Investment Officer over at Crescent Capital. Jack, what else should we be thinking about? You were talking about the Fed and the open mouth policy, which sounds a little derisive. It makes it sound like you wish that the chairman would not say much. Am I reading too much into that?
No, I mean, I think the problem is the Fed has really only this one blunt instrument, interest rates. Yeah. And so what they really try to do is, if they can talk the market into submission or kind of pull back, then perhaps it's more talk and less action that they'll ultimately have to take. You know, if the market kept, if you recall, you know, the market rallied from, you know, the middle of June through the first week of August, when clearly Fed chairman was upset during the Jackson Hole meetings and started really blasting the market and talking it down. And then we had that big reversal. So I think that's just one of the tools in their toolkit, of, you know, and it's one that they hope to use, that they don't have to, you know, raise interest rates on everybody. So it's just a, you know, all part of the jawboning package that investors need to have to grapple with on a week-to-week basis. Really, the big wild card, of course, is inflation. It's sort of like that hurricane that's spinning out there. We just don't know, you know, if it will ramp up, where it will go, how intense will it be, and we're just kind of watching it. And unfortunately, it's a monthly number against a backdrop where investors want answers every minute, and that part is frustrating.
You think the market is fairly priced, though, right?
I do. So if you think about owning equities, you're really only entitled to two things: earnings and dividends. Then that's pretty much it. However, sometimes the value of those earnings can change pretty dramatically over time. That's what the P/E ratio is. And I equate the P/E ratio with interest rates. It's really just a simple discount mechanism. So what I did was I went back to 2007. This was the last time the 10-year Treasury was around the same interest rate as where it is today. And I ran forward all of the cumulative earnings and cumulative dividends just over time. And then I matched against that the total return of the S&P 500. And if the S&P was higher than the cumulative rate of earnings and dividends, then that would suggest that the market's overvalued. If the market trailed, it would suggest it's undervalued. And lo and behold, John, the growth in the market is almost right on top mm-hmm. of earnings and dividend growth all the way back to 2007.
Yeah, I'm looking at that chart, and that's interesting. So we still have inflation. What do you think is going to happen to prices after the first of the year?
Okay, so I do think that inflation will trend lower on its own. Obviously, we've got a little help now with the higher interest rates and pullback in demand. I also think the supply side of the equation, at least on the goods side, is improving. If we look at shipping rates and trucking rates and the cost of moving goods around the world has come down a lot, suggesting that, okay, we've moved from shortages to abundance. So really the issue is the service side, right? We've got two job openings for every one unemployed person looking for a job right now, and that's continues to put upward pressure on wages. Yeah. And we have a jobs report tomorrow where economists are expecting nearly 200,000 new jobs will be created. So clearly this doesn't appear to be a jobs market that's softening anytime soon. So I do believe that prices will come down on goods next year. I think the service side of things is going to be pretty sticky next year. And, I'm hopeful that if we can just get a gradual slowdown in demand across the board, that will push inflation back toward that 2% number, but we're a far cry from 2%.
Okay, Jack, let's visit again soon. It's always interesting to hear your analysis. He's the Chief Investment Officer and Founding Partner at Crescent Capital. You can read more at crescentcapital.com. Thanks for joining us today. WGN, Ali Marotti, reporter on consumer products, food, restaurants, retail, media, advertising, all of that stuff for Cranes, joins us now on the Wintrust Business Lunch to talk a little bit about some of the big players in the Chicago area. Ali, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're all aware of the fact that there's this potential merger to take place between the two major grocery chains in the Chicago area. I did not know that so many attorneys general were fighting this.
Yes, there are quite a few politicians and lawmakers fighting this, actually. The most recent development is that yesterday, Illinois' Attorney General Kwame Raoul filed a lawsuit, and he joined in with the attorneys general from the District of Columbia and California in doing that. And what the lawsuit's trying to do is stop Jewel Osco's parent, Albertsons, from paying out almost $4 billion to the grocery company's shareholders. The attorneys general are worried that if Albertsons does pay that out to shareholders, they won't be able to compete in the marketplace and therefore have to make some sort of argument to federal regulators that they have to merge with Kroger. And this is one where, you know, these two supermarket giants coming together are sure to spark kind of, you know, antitrust concerns with federal regulators. So I think the lawmakers and the politicians, the attorneys general, are seeing trying to read the writing on the wall. I think the Albertsons may be trying to circumnavigate some of those concerns.
Right. So maybe Jewel merges with Mariano's, as it were. Maybe
exactly.
Not. Would they brand themselves as a separate store then, a new corporate name on the front of the store, or would they all be, what would happen to the names on the front of the grocery stores?
That's a great question. So Kroger and Albertsons haven't said one way or the other, but I talked to experts about this who said that typically when grocery stores merge, they do keep the branding. And that's just because people in the local markets are so loyal to their grocery stores. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a Mariano's that you shop at weekly, if suddenly the names change, you're going to get a major attitude toward it. And experts tell me that companies realize that, so they do tend to keep the brands on there. One thing we might see change, though, is so in this proposed deal, basically, you know, Mariano's parent would be acquiring Jewel. So what we would probably see inside of Jewel stores, similar to what we saw after Kroger acquired Mariano's back in 2015, some of those Kroger private label brands coming in and filling the shelves, you know, throughout the stores.
We talked to an analyst shortly after this was announced, and they said it will be difficult for some employees, maybe at the corporate level, as two companies merge. That happens with every industry. But they didn't see it as necessarily a negative for consumers. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, I'm hearing different things, right? You know, as soon as this deal was announced, I think a lot of people predicted that there would be backlash from politicians, from federal regulators. And the reasoning behind that is because right now we're in this massively inflationary environment, and the grocery aisles are the number one way that people see inflation, right? I mean, prices are up really high year over year because of inflation in the grocery stores. And people are concerned that when two big companies merge, the competition will go down, and therefore they will be able to raise prices even further. Now, what the two companies have said is that actually when they do merge, they will use some of the money they can save. Typically, a bigger company can strike deals with some of the suppliers like Kraft Heinz or Mondelez, you know, to get better deals, and therefore they will have lower prices on the shelves for consumers. But experts say, you know, that kind of remains to be seen what will actually play out. So we are hearing, you know, kind of two different sides of that here.
They're not the only players in the Chicago market, or I presume D.C. and California. How is this antitrust? I mean, is that that's what they're saying, too, right? That this is anti-competitive?
That's a concern. You know, we haven't heard from federal regulators yet, and we likely won't until, you know, it could be some time before we hear from them. Kroger and Albertsons have said that basically, you know, they plan to spin off some of these stores to fend off those concerns. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that when regulators look at these deals, they get hyper-local. They go down to the block. So if there's a Mariano's one block away from a Kroger, they might say, these compete too directly. You have to sell this Jewel, or you have to sell this Mariano's to make the deal go through. So it would be a hyper local analysis like that to see specifically which stores are competing directly with the others. And they may factor in other things too. You know, how many other grocery stores are in the area? Is there Whole Foods nearby and Aldi? What does the situation look like in this neighborhood, in this town? So there's kind of a lot of questions that remain here. I think it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Kind of clever, not that you can do a $4 billion payout to your shareholders under the radar, but the idea, if I understand you correctly, is the Jewel Osco parent company says, all right, we'll go ahead and pay out this dividend. Now we will seem cash-strapped. Therefore, this merger is necessary for our viability. But Kwame Raoul and the rest of them are wise to that, huh?
That's what they're saying. And, you know, for its part, Albertsons did say that that payout was not tied to the merger at all. It would happen regardless of whether the merger occurred. And they, you know, discount those accusations and allegations. You know, they deny them. But yes, you're right. That is what the attorneys general are worried about.
How's Portillo's doing?
Yeah, so Portillo's is doing okay. You know, I've been following how a lot of I cover McDonald's too, and just it's kind of interesting to see, you know, how high prices are in the grocery store. They're also high at restaurants as well. And you're seeing some customers turn to the fast food and the fast casual chains like McDonald's and Portillo's. Portillo's did serve more people in the third quarter than they did in the second quarter. They have this interesting strategy with inflation where, you know, they want their restaurants to be sort of an oasis and not increase their menu prices as fast as their competitors, but they still have to do it. You know, prices are up really high for them, like they are across the restaurant world. So they're increasing their prices. You know, they're doing okay, but their profits are down, and that does concern Wall Street. So since they went public, you know, in 2021, their share price is down pretty significantly since then.
Oh, well, I'll quote from your article on that. I thought that was interesting. After debuting at $20 in October and peaking around $54 in November, Portillo stock has tumbled more than 48% to $22.60 a share. I don't know what to make of that. It seems to me like the hamburgers are still pretty good, and they're not that much more expensive. What's the downward pressure here?
Yeah, so you're right. Portillo's does really well at getting people through the lines really quickly, and that helps them grow. You know, they are able to, if you can keep people moving through your drive-through in a way the way that Portillo's can, then your revenues are going to be up. And in fact, their revenues are up. But, you know, as I said, you know, their profits are down, and that's because it's more expensive to build new stores, which is something that they're doing. You know, it's more expensive to hire people, which is also something that they're doing as they continue to grow. They're opening in new markets. They're about to open their first store in Texas. They opened their first store in Florida earlier this year. So they are expanding quite a bit, and inflation is costing them a lot in that area. So at the same time, they're trying not to raise their menu prices too much so that people keep coming in and aren't scared away by inflation. It's kind of a long-term strategy that the CEO is taking there. You know, they want to make sure people keep coming in, even though it might hurt their margins a little bit now as they're putting all this money into expanding, so that, you know, over the long term, the customers see them as a value and continue to come to them.
And Ali Marotti's reporting, she notes that while their competition has seen prices go up 8.5%, Portillo's prices have gone up 8.1%. That's that price lagging that you're talking about. And so while we feel it, it could be worse. And I sure hope they stay viable and successful. That's Ali Marotti. Let's talk again, Ali. Keep doing the reporting you're doing, and we'll catch you another day.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
She's a reporter in a whole host of categories, certainly the food, for ChicagoBusiness.com. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Rent increases are moderating in Chicago's downtown. Crane says new data shows rent at top-tier apartment buildings fell about a dime per square foot in the third quarter, but we're still up about 8.5% higher than last year. Integra Realty Resources compiles the stats. Tenants in those apartments saw increases exceeding 20% as the economy began recovering from the pandemic. Moderating rents are good news for the local economy, as rising rents are a driver of inflation. Strong local job market has boosted demand for apartments over the past 18 months, resulting in rising occupancy levels. Chicago's Northwestern Memorial Hospital is the first in Illinois to perform a heart transplant after it stopped beating. Surgeons at the hospital performed the heart transplant October 12th using a machine nicknamed Heart in a Box. Hearts are usually only considered for transplant if the donor suffers brain death, but the donor's heart is still beating in their body. The heart-in-a-box device allows surgeons to use hearts from donors whose heart and respiratory systems have shut down. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Mm-hmm. and we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. I didn't get around to mentioning this last week, but it was National Bat Week.
This ball is crushed.
No, not that kind.
I want to soak your blood.
Not that kind either, although there are vampire bats, but they live in Central and South America. Here, the little furry things that do not suck your blood can be scary, especially when they show up inside your house, as, well, happened twice to a certain midday host here on the Blowtorch.
So I tiptoe up to the doorwell. The door's open in the bathroom there, and he's just hanging there upside down.
And they can carry rabies, so if you have an encounter with one of the 11 varieties that live in Illinois, check with a doctor. But bats, in general, are beneficial, and Bat Week was all about understanding them and protecting them. Roger Perry is with the U.S. Forest Service.
Bats are one of the few nocturnal insect consumers. Significant effects on agriculture and forestry by reducing insect populations. They reduce mosquitoes.
They're also pollinators for some plants, and they spread seeds that grow new plants and trees, but they face a number of dangers.
The biggest threat to them right now is a disease called white nose syndrome. This syndrome has killed off millions of bats.
And not to mention danger from humans, and Roger Perry urges us to just leave them be if possible.
A lot of them roost in old abandoned buildings and houses and things like this, and trying to maintain those populations as long as they're not creating a nuisance for the homeowner, not trying to remove them unless it's necessary.
And you can even take it a step further. Build a bat house.
There are plans available online for building bat houses, or you can buy a bat house from your local hardware store to put up to provide roosting habitat for them in the summertime.
There are more tips on how you can be a friend to bats at batweek.org. From the farm to your belly, today's National Sandwich Day, and my top three are turkey, BLT, and PB&J. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Parts along the highways, especially as you get just outside Chicago, and you see some warehouses that are next to warehouses. The one by Macy's off of I-80 outside of Minooka is small compared to the other two that are next to it. The things are the size of villages. And guess what? There are more and more of those going up.
I think what we're to make of it is that since the end of the Great Recession and the sort of rise of e-commerce, warehouses have just become one of the hottest asset classes in commercial real estate around. They're just tremendously valuable, and developers are eager to put up as many of them as possible.
Yeah. By the way, Jake Swearingen's on a phone line with us, and I presume that the growth of these is because everybody wants to get their goods as quickly as possible, so the manufacturers need to get them to distributors all around the country. We shop online, we want something in 2 days. It better not be on the other side of the country, right?
Exactly. If you're going to do two-day shipping, it needs to be staged. The product needs to be waiting very close to where the consumer is. And so that means a lot of places like Chicago, a lot of places in the Midwest that are relatively close to a large portion of the U.S. population, are seeing a tremendous number of warehouses come in. And it's, you know, growth that was happening for a while, but really after, you know, 2010, it really started to accelerate. And then during the pandemic, we saw it sort of kick in the afterburners.
So these are construction jobs. They're jobs for people to work in the warehouses, and I get my stuff. What's the downside of all of this?
I mean, I think the downside is, it's a mixed blessing. You're right that it brings jobs. The issue of tax abatements are usually offered and usually sought by developers before they locate a warehouse. So a lot of times you have warehouses coming in that put a tremendous strain on local infrastructure, things like first responders. Warehouses get a lot of injuries in them. You get a lot more, fire trucks, EMTs needing to go out. Mm-hmm. And the warehouse may have a tax abatement that goes on for a decade. So they're not necessarily kicking in towards that. They're good jobs in many ways, especially for sort of traditional blue-collar workers. They pay usually about double minimum wage, if not more, but they're also dangerous. Warehouse is more dangerous than logging, more dangerous than construction,
really,
more dangerous than mining. People get injured doing warehouse work a lot.
You also said that the burn rate at an Amazon warehouse, on average, is 158%. I presume that means most people they hire don't last a year?
Yeah, the average tenure of somebody working in an Amazon warehouse is about 8 months. That was from an internal memo that Amazon put out where they were basically, this was in 2020, they were trying to sound the alarm within the company that they were worried that they were going to run out of sort of the available labor pool for warehouses in some cities by 2024. And, you know, that was before they really went into a hiring frenzy that we saw at the end of 2021.
Yeah. You also note in your article, here's just, and this is Amazon alone, they employ, you said, roughly 700,000 people in their warehouses and have been hiring on average 2,800 people a day, 500,000 people in the second half of 2021 alone. Those numbers are staggering to me.
It is. It is. And, you know, when you think about, you know, 500,000 people, you know, that's a small town sort of going through a company. It is, you know, it's one of the many things that as we did this piece about warehousing that just sort of made me stop and think about, you know, how big a change has happened. To be clear, Amazon since has, along with a lot of other companies, has sort of pumped the brakes on this very rapid growth. I think a lot of people thought the growth that we were seeing during the pandemic in e-commerce was going to continue. It's since slowed, and Amazon's pumped the brakes a little bit on its expansion, but it's still planning on bringing in, I believe, another 100,000 workers for the holiday peak. So, you know, it's still, a lot of people are still going to be working in Amazon warehouses regardless.
Well, UPS had a two-day job fair here. It's online as well. They're looking to hire 60,000 people in the Chicago area for seasonal work.
Oh, yeah.
60,000.
I mean, Chicago is, I believe, the third largest labor source for warehouse work. About 200,000 people work in warehouses in the Chicago metro. And it's, you know, really right now, it's still, in the labor market for warehouse work, it's still tight. You know, there is more demand for warehouse workers than there is supply, generally. Yeah.
Jake Swearingen is the deputy editor for retail and transportation. It's nice to talk to you, Jake, over at Insider. Let's visit again. I enjoyed your reporting today.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for talking.